Well, you remember the movie Blazing Saddles?
Of course.
One of the funniest scenes was Mel Brooks was the governor, and he was standing around in his office, and there were several other gentlemen standing around, all dressed in suits and that. And his response to a comment or whatever was, "Harumph." And then he had to point at all the other ones and say, "I didn't get a harumph from you." Well, that's what these I use that example. That's what these college professors do, is they stand around and go harumph all day to each other, you know, thinking lofty, great thoughts and that, and have absolutely no understanding of life in the real world, of the challenges that these young people are going to face when they get out in the real world with their flashy new college degree that qualifies them to do nothing but maybe operate the French fry machine at a McDonald's.
It's good to be the king. This is Jamie Williamson. You're listening to OPSEC Radio on the America Out Loud Network. With me today, I've got Del Wilbur, retired counterterrorism expert and CIA officer. Del, welcome.
Thank you. You've also got Bosco, my English bulldog. He's sitting in here right next to me, ready to chime in whenever it's appropriate.
Okay, well, we'll see. I think I managed to get rid of mine. Well,
when he sees a rabbit or a squirrel run by or whatever, that's when it'll be appropriate.
So. Right. So here we are, post-election. We've still got the nonsense, the hypocritical nonsense, the appalling thing to not accept the results of the election. Well, shoes on the other foot now, Mrs. Clinton. It doesn't fit very well. So we'll go through this nonsense for another week or two with the recounts and let Jill Stein fill her coffers and let Hillary play her shenanigans with the elections that she was so critical of Mr. Trump for. So, but I think from the perspective of OPSEC, I am seriously hoping that our job will be a little bit easier, because as some of you listeners may know, we were a victim of the weaponized IRS under the Obama administration, thanks to Mr. Koskinen and Ms. Lerner. However, we won our lawsuit. And I said, it's hard to remain nonpartisan or bipartisan when you've got 8 years of a Democratic administration breaking federal laws, violating U.S. code, and making egregious acts of omission or commission in regard to national security. So hopefully those days are over. Del, what do you think we've got to, as far as looking at the recent appointments, well, we'll say selections or pending selections for cabinet choices?
Well, first of all, let me say that far beyond the last 8 years, but for the last two or three decades, we've been up against a mentality where that operates under the process that the ends justify the means. And that's exactly what the Obama administration did for the last 8 years, in violating the laws that they did and attacking the people that or the groups of people that they felt stood or perhaps presented a challenge to what they were trying to achieve, which, in his own words, was a fundamental transformation of the United States of America.
Unfortunately, I think he succeeded in that.
Well, he certainly has made some serious steps in that direction. But that's a process that's been going on now for decades, literally decades, in our colleges and universities. So, but anyway, to get back to the point of your question, what I have seen so far, the nominees for the various positions and that within a Trump administration, I'm very pleased over. You certainly know him much better than I only know him by reputation, but I think the choice of General Flynn for National Security Advisor is just a super choice, and I think it is something that you know, that will serve President Trump well in his decisions that he makes with regards to the nation's security. So I think that's one that I'm sure both you and I can agree on. And,
yeah, I was beyond pleased. You know, my initial thought was that General Flynn was going to be appointed as the DNI, but with a national security advisor in that position, first of all, there's no problem overcoming a nomination because it's an appointed position. It doesn't have to be confirmed by Congress, but he will have tremendously more authority and power of proximity, I guess, as a trusted advisor in that position. And I think that he and President-elect Trump are simpatico on many, many issues related to national security. Having worked for General Flynn and having been involved, I guess he's been an advisor of sorts informally to OPSEC. He certainly has been aware of what all we've been doing. I don't see how he could have had a better choice than General Flynn.
I would certainly agree.
And KT McFarland, as a deputy, I think she's fantastic. She is a very smart lady. She's been around for a long time. I've read her stuff. I've listened to her on the news, and I think that she and General Flynn will make a great pair and offer sage advice to the president. And I think both of those individuals, I don't know KT, I have a lot of respect for her and her views, but neither of them are yes people. And Trump never surrounded himself, I don't think, with yes people. I think I've never watched The Apprentice, but I don't think he wants somebody that's going to kiss his ass. I think he's going to want advice backed up by reason, and he'll make his decision based on that advice, whether he agrees with it or not. And I think that's exactly what he'll be given from both of those individuals. We had myself and some other veterans, some members of OPSEC, some not, back at the end of October prior to elections, sat down with Mr. Trump, and we were advising him on the capacity of Veterans Affairs issues and what problems different individuals were having personally and also systemically within the system. And we were able to give him unadulterated advice without a political agenda. And I think that's what he needs. That's what any president needs from an advisor that will shoot straight and tell it like they see it, whether or not it's necessarily in agreement with his views. So,
yeah, I mean, I've heard that about Trump, that, you know, the fact that he seeks out the counsel of people that don't necessarily agree with him or don't necessarily they don't tell him what he wants to hear. And I don't think anyone in that position could have achieved the level of success, you know, by hiring only, you know, yes men or yes women. And you mentioned KT McFarland, and I think obviously I agree with your assessment of her. I think she is absolutely a sharp lady. And the one thing I think that she adds and brings to her position, which will benefit General Flynn, is she does have experience in Washington, and she, I think, will be in a good position to help him navigate some of the pitfalls and the political BS that's going to arise, you know, during a Trump administration. You know, she's got the experience, and she's navigated through those waters before in the past. So I think she will be a definite a benefit to have on the team.
Yeah, I think they will be good foils for one another in terms of just a pure military from a strategic intelligence view, which he's had, but may perhaps, and maybe it's a good thing that he's naive in the ways of Washington, that at least he's not polluted by that. But KT is savvy enough, having been around it since the Reagan administration, that, yeah, I agree that she will be able to help him navigate some of the more treacherous waters of D.C. politics.
One of the names that we haven't heard, or at least I have not heard it, which is kind of surprising, is I thought that there might be some interest in some senior position anyway for someone like Alan West, but I haven't heard his name come up at all, and I'm kind of curious as to why we've not heard his name mentioned.
You know, that's funny. I hadn't thought about it until you mentioned it, but Alan West has been such a tremendous supporter, and he's been very vocal, you know, with his website and postings and stuff. I don't know that he's actually seeking a position. Now, with General Flynn's appointment as a National Security Advisor, that leaves open the DNI position, the Director of National Intelligence. Colonel West was an infantry guy, not necessarily an intelligence guy. But no, I haven't heard his name at all. Now, who I have heard for Director of National Intelligence was Rudy Giuliani. Not sure that he wants that position. Apparently, he's turned down the Attorney General position, and he's in contention for Secretary of State, but I had heard that his name was put forward as Director of National Intelligence, and I think he'd be outstanding in that position, should he choose to accept it.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think he, I think he's a you know, very capable individual in whatever position you know that he entered into, because he's just got the I think the innate ability to make the right decision at the right time, and he's got obviously the intelligence and the background behind him, so he certainly would be a good selection for anything. You know, there might be some position that West may be considered for, you know, with Homeland Security, perhaps in an undersecretary position or some, you know, there's certainly undersecretary positions at the Department of Defense in that. So, you know, hopefully we'll see his name rise up here one of these days, because I think he would be a great addition to the administration. I've met the gentleman. I've been, you know, highly impressed with him, and you know, would love to see him, you know, filling a position somewhere in the administration.
Yeah, I think he certainly would be a benefit. Although I think who I've heard for Homeland Security, again, Giuliani and Sheriff Clark, David Clark of Milwaukee County. And the other one I've heard is Chris Kobach. You know, Joe Arpaio's in there too, maybe, but I think Arpaio would be better heading the U.S. Border Patrol.
And or the problem Arpaio has against him is his age. I mean, he's 81 or 82 years old now, so I think that's, you know, might be held against him. I don't know anything about the man's health. I mean, he might be healthy as a horse, but that certainly might be a consideration. But who knows? But yeah, I have heard his name. I would, you know, I think I told you before that that I spent a couple of years as a contractor working for DHS down on the southwest border.
Right, right.
And, you know, I was an intelligence officer contracted with the Office of Intelligence and Analysis down in El Paso. And, you know, I certainly was an eye-opener for me getting down there. I knew that we had problems along the southwest border, as all Americans do. You know, you see little tidbits on the news or whatever, and, you know, and you know that there's some problems down there. But until I actually got down there and started attending the regular briefings that they had, I was astonished at how bad it was. And, you know, the level of drug smuggling going on was just, I mean, you know, we're talking tonnage, you know.
Mm-hmm. And what we interdict is just scratching the surface of what we know about.
Absolutely. I mean, it's getting to the point to where they are putting a load of dope, and then they're literally building a car around it, you know, or a truck around it, or whatever, in order to conceal it. I mean, that's how intricate they've gotten down there in their efforts to defeat our scanners and everything else on the border crossing points. But anyway, I know that from my experience with DHS, you're going to need someone going in there who maybe not necessarily a bull in the china closet, but certainly someone that is willing to go in and make some changes, because it is an organization, at least from my perspective, that needs a thorough cleansing, because there's some serious issues within DHS, politically motivated decisions being made as opposed to, you know, what's right. And, you know, one of the things that I argued for when I was down there working was that we needed to do more to support state and local law enforcement. You know, I was going out for ride-alongs with the local sheriff's office, you know, the Doñana County Sheriff's Office down there in New Mexico, the El Paso Sheriff's Office, the El Paso Police, the Texas Rangers and DPS. And, you know, I was spending as much time as I could out of the office and actually, you know, working with the frontline people to try to get a real perspective as to what the challenges were. And, you know, instead of offering them, you know, help to try to make their lives better and easier and help them do their jobs better, you know, DHS, Office of Intelligence and Analysis was more interested on what we could squeeze out of them for intel reports that we could send up to the intelligence community. And I felt it should be just the opposite. We need to be bringing the resources of the federal intelligence community down to their level to help them. And so it was, you know, it was certainly a frustrating time for me. And
I remember you telling me some of the frustrating stories in terms of personnel and interoffice politics and everything else that seemed to rise to a greater importance than defending our borders and the security of the country.
Oh, it was, like I said, it was certainly, you know, the level of problems we have on the border was eye-opening. And then, the fact that there just didn't seem to be the right direction as far as, again, this is, you know, from my perspective, but I remember talking, you know, with the sheriff's deputies and whatever, you know, local law enforcement down there, and asked them, I says, you know, what is it you guys need? What can we do to help you? And, you know, part of the problem was that they didn't possess the security clearance necessary to share information with them. Well, my God, then, let's get them the security clearance they need.
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. Well, it's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. You'll find a whole host of shows and a lineup of great content back at AmericaOutLoud.com.
They didn't possess the security clearance necessary to share information with them. Well, my God, then let's get them the security clearance they need. You know,
that should be, that's an administrative function that should be fairly easy. And this was all since the creation of Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was the Office of Intelligence and Analysis is who I worked for. And, you know, they, like I said, the problem or much of the problem, you know, it had to do with the lack of security clearance. So information that we had in our possession that might be useful to state and local law enforcement to help them develop their strategies against the drug smuggling or other activities going on, you know, on the southwest border, we couldn't share that information with them. I remember one occasion where we had I had a sheriff's deputy, I did a ride along with him on one occasion, and he pointed out, took me to an area right along the border there in New Mexico. It showed me, he pointed off to a facility that was, it looked like a huge ranch type facility. It was in Mexico. It was maybe, you know, a couple thousand yards inside Mexico. And he suspected that there was drug activity going on there. New Mexico was that area was experiencing some what we had determined were ultralight aircraft flyovers that were coming in, flying in, you know, dropping a load of dope, a couple hundred pounds of dope at a prearranged location inside the U.S., and then they were turning right around and flying right back into Mexico. And he was curious about this facility asked if there was anything I could do to help him get a handle on what, you know, what the activity was that was going on there. And unfortunately, you know, there was information that I could provide, but I couldn't tell him how we got it or what it consisted of, because it was all classified, you know.
And that was the whole point of, you know, to be able to facilitate the intelligence sharing and, you know, the interagency coordination. My involvement, as a lieutenant colonel, I was the senior military counter drug officer for Special Operations Command, and there was tons of money. I watched Biggs Army Airfield grow from, you know, basically a desert airstrip into this, you know, over the horizon sprawling installation. I mean, there was tons of federal money that was going in there. But the whole securing our borders, it's more than just the drugs. It's more than just the illegal aliens, the immigrants. It's what else is coming across the border and who else is coming across the border that may wish this country harm. And then there's also, it's just not economically sustainable. I mean, it's simple mathematics that we can't afford to. You know, we've got veterans that are homeless on the streets, yet we're supporting medical care and you know, feeding and EBT cards and God knows what else. I feel for them, but, you know, they're here in our country illegally. They're not undocumented workers. They're illegal aliens. They're not American citizens. They don't have rights because they came here illegally. And
yeah, I mean, it's frustrating because, you know, and I know from having been down there and that you know, and we know that our agricultural industry depends upon many of these people. And I understand that, you know, so why don't we create, and I think, in fact, I think President-elect Trump even mentioned this, why don't we create a guest worker program of some sort, you know, to extend some legal residency to these people. You know, they come here, they live here while they're working and that. They go back to Mexico when the harvest season or the growing season or whatever is over, or perhaps it's a year-round thing and they have to stay. But it may provide some sort of legal residency here where they can then, you know, come out of the shadows, contribute taxes, contribute to the, you know, the economy and that, and then not have to worry about being, you know, being and then the effort of the Border Patrol and the immigration people can be focused on finding the MS-13 illegal aliens, you know, the gang members and the criminals that are here. So, I mean, I'm open to their some sort of arrangement made, you know, that will benefit both, you know, our businesses here that depend upon them and those, you know, decent, hardworking, you know, Mexicans that are just trying to, you know, care for their families and provide a better life for themselves. So,
and I think that reflects the sentiments of the majority of the country. I mean, we have to have rules of law. That's what our nation is based on, is rule of law. Now that we're past the election, a lot of the rhetoric, like not just Trump, but any candidate, you know, once elected, starts to gravitate back towards the center so he or she can govern and unite the country. And, you know, it's not so much breaking campaign promises. Yeah, we're going to build a wall. And will Mexico pay for it? Well, you know, maybe through, they're not going to write a check, but there's other ways through grants and money that we give to Mexico that will no longer be forthcoming, that can be diverted. I don't think anybody truly believed that he was going to brick by brick wall off the entire U.S.-Mexican border. In some places, it's not feasible. But I think we are going to see a tightening of immigration policies. But I think we're going to see it with compassion. With all the illegals that are in the United States, it's not feasible, not economically. We don't have the manpower. And I don't think we have the cold heart to do that. But I think we will crack down on the so-called sanctuary cities and the multiple offenders and the felons, the illegal aliens that are here committing crimes, not the hardworking, and not just Mexicans. I mean, from all over, but primarily Central America. And that goes back to what I think a leading contender for Homeland Security is a fellow by the name of Chris Kobach. From Missouri, I don't know. Do you know who Chris is?
No, the name's not familiar. So he's trying to place it before.
He's the Secretary of State for Kansas, but he's written immigration laws for Arizona, I believe possibly for New Mexico, but he's a young and upcoming guy. Now, I met him, a friend of mine from college, her husband, I believe, is party chairman for the state of Missouri or the state of Kansas. Anyway, I met Chris Kobach. I had no idea who he was. He had a picture perfect, beautiful wife, beautiful children, just a good looking, smart, friendly guy that treated you like his equal. I had a chance to talk with him for maybe like 10 minutes. But I thought, wow, this guy is really impressive. I don't even know if he was Secretary of State at the time. Since then, though, I would start seeing him. I'm like, oh, wow, that's Chris Kobach. You know, he's on TV as advisor to Arizona, you know, writing immigration policy and, you know, this and that and the other. Well, he's also been a leading advisor to Donald Trump for immigration policy. So I think that makes him a contender for Homeland Security or possibly another position within the administration. But I think he would take a common sense approach to what is realistically doable and what is good for the country at the same time, balance between compassion for those people who are trying to make a better life for themselves and their families versus all the others who are here to cause problem, to ride off the system. So I think I love Dave Clark. I think he's a great guy. I think he's done great things for Milwaukee County. I'm not sure that he would be the best choice to work at the national level. for DHS. I know Giuliani's name has been floated around for that position as well. He's kind of a maybe a jack of all trades kind of guy that can be plugged in.
But, yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, he's certainly capable of I think doing an excellent job in whatever position he was appointed to. So, and I agree with your assessment of Sheriff Clark. I think he's a great guy. I just don't know that being an administrator of such a large entity like Homeland Security is something that he could excel at. There's probably a better position for him in the administration than heading up a huge bureaucracy like DHS. Like I said, you don't necessarily want somebody to come in like a bull in a china closet, but you certainly want someone to come in who can take a clear and level-headed approach to recognizing what the problems are, getting the right people in a position to deal with those problems, and then dealing with the political side that obviously any secretary has to deal with, in his appearances before, Congress and the Senate and such. So I love Clark. I think he's a great guy. I love Alan West. I think he's a great guy. I think they would be great additions to the administration. Just got to find the right position to plug them into.
Well, and that takes us, that's a good segue into Department of Veterans Affairs, Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Scott Brown, former Massachusetts senator. I like Scott Brown. Never met him, but he's a level-headed guy. He's an Army colonel, or maybe he's retired from the reserves by now. But again, Scott, being a reservist and being a veteran himself, yeah, that's great. But I'm not sure that Scott Brown has the business acumen to run as huge an organization. I believe that Department of Veterans Affairs is outsized only by Department of Defense. I could be wrong, but it's a huge organization, and it has huge problems right now, systemically. And I'm not sure that Brown is the right guy to do that. In fact, Mr. Trump had asked me, or asked us collectively, the question was, how about the guy who's running it now, which was Bob McDonald? And the guy next to me, who actually works for the VA, we kind of whispered later, why didn't he say his name? Certainly he knows Bob McDonald from Procter & Gamble days. He was a force to be reckoned with in his own right. A veteran himself, but he ran Procter & Gamble, a huge company. And I said, he's got the acumen, he's got all the tools needed to run that organization. For that matter, so did Eric Shinseki, being chief of staff of the Army. But like I told Mr. Trump, that the Secretary of Veterans Affairs is only as powerful as the president allows them to be. I said, so it's not a political appointee. The fact that the guy's a veteran, yeah, maybe that's important and maybe that helps. But what's most important is, A, that whatever individual is tapped to be Secretary of the VA has that business acumen and experience to run a huge corporation or department in this case. And I don't know if Scott Brown is that guy. I would feel better having a non-veteran, but somebody coming from Trump's circle of business associates, like Lee Iacocca, and I just throw that name out there, but somebody who's run a huge company and with the backing of the president can cut through,
Well, I mean, the VA, you mentioned Iacocca and people like him from the business world, they certainly are going to need to have the power of the presidency behind them, not just the power of the presidency, but of Congress and the Senate as well, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the very first VA secretary was Omar Bradley, former, general of the Army.
And you may be right. Yeah,
I think he is the one who actually stood up the VA. I could be wrong on that. Certainly don't have any knowledge of how the VA did during his tenure. But the problem that, and I deal with the VA for my health care, and the problems that I see are certainly systemic within the VA. Is a company like, or a businessman like an Iacocca, is used to having the ability to hire and fire at will. And I mean, basically, you know, you want to run an efficient company, then you clean house if necessary. And the problem with the VA is the bureaucracy that surrounds it.
And that's exactly what I told Mr. Trump back in October, is that whoever that secretary is, he or she needs to have your authority and your power to hire and fire who they see fit. I said, right now, it's like, you know, you have tenure in the federal government, and all these people, like on the IRS side, you know, Koskinen and Lois Lerner, you know, they're still drawing a paycheck by the taxpayers with all the crimes and abuses of power that they've committed. And the same thing with some of the senior leadership in within Veterans Affairs. And it's below the secretary level. I mean, I think Shinseki did the right thing. He was an honorable man, and the scandals that happened occurred on his watch. And he manned up and took responsibility for it and resigned. I don't think it was a lack of leadership or failures on his part, but he didn't have the authority and the empowerment of the president. And maybe he didn't have the will. I don't know. But nothing changed. And something has to change now at the SES level, the senior executive service. Nobody above GS 14, probably 15 for sure, should get bonuses for doing their job. For the most part, I think the rank and file workers of the VA are tremendous individuals who care about the patients and care about their work. There's always the 10% like you find in any job that are there for a paycheck, and we have to deal with them too, but they're so hard to get rid of. And worse at the higher levels.
Generally, I have been generally very satisfied with the medical support that I've gotten from the VA. I had no problems with the doctors and nurses I've dealt with, nor with the medical procedures I've had in that. I've been very satisfied. It is the people who answer the telephone, people who make appointments, who, you know, they've been sitting there on their fat behind for 20 years doing the job the same way, not really giving a damn about the guy on the other end who's calling in and who's getting more and more frustrated because of her attitude or his attitude that he deals with on the other side of the phone. I mean, that is where, a great place to start would be to put these people at the lower levels on notice that, you know what, you guys' job is on the line. You either start, doing it correctly. I think there's also some antiquated systems involved, that also create frustrations because veterans call in and their phone is routed through, 12 different switchboard systems or whatever, and calls get dropped repeatedly. And I would assume that much of that is probably, technological failures. So, those are the kinds of things that just drive veterans crazy and sour their opinion of the VA as a whole. If you could fix some of those things. So I don't know. If a VA secretary had the ability to pick up the phone and say, "Hey, Mr. President, this is what I need to do," and there's going to be some uproar about it because some people are going to lose their jobs, but I need your support. And if he has it, then maybe a business person like an Iacocca or somebody can come in and clean house and do what needs to be done. But it definitely is going to take the support of the president in order to fix the VA.
And that was the focus of our advice to him, was to introduce what a novel concept of accountability and responsibility and having firing authority at all levels. Because we talked about just, you know, my wife is going through this bureaucratic nightmare with her father right now. Although a lot of it is being outsourced from the VA, and the care itself has been great. He hasn't had to pay for the surgery. It's just dealing with the bureaucracy and things not being entered into his record correctly and getting put on hold or dropped calls or rerouted to somebody else who knows nothing. And it's that frustration that just eats up time, and it's an inefficient organization.
It's like being in an episode of The Twilight Zone about the Department of Motor Vehicles. The biggest frustrations I've experienced have been just been dealing with, you know, the people that you have to go through in order to get to a doctor or a nurse. And but the medical care I've gotten, I've not been unsatisfied with. I mean, it's been a positive experience. But, you know, I know that that's not the case in every, you know, every VA hospital or every VA clinic around the country. So there's certainly improvement to be made. That's for sure.
We had talked about, you know, the panacea is to over-medicate or to medicate instead of fix, which I think personally leads to, I think the number is far greater than 22 suicides a day. I think it's a far greater number because they're tracking largely active duty veterans and they don't have the metrics on people that have retired, separated from service, and may or may not be in the VA system. But, you know, I had broken my back from a parachute accident, and, you know, their solution was to give me narcotics. And, you know, the muscle relaxers are great. I don't want narcotics. I want, you know, steroid injections or surgery, God forbid, if that's what's necessary. But I don't want them to mask the pain with narcotics to the point where I can't function. I want them to fix it. That's what they're supposed to do. And that's the frustration of, you know, one of the other fellows that was there, Master Sergeant out of 5th Group. Worse than my problem, his was combat injury. He got blown up. He had traumatic brain injuries, spinal injuries, and the exact same thing. You know, he doesn't want to be doped up and turned into a vegetable. You know, he wants to get the medical procedures necessary to fix him. And I think that's the frustration of, you know, it's the system.
And that contributes, I think, to some of those suicides, is the frustration that I just described about, you know, calling in and trying to get through to somebody, and you're dealing with a bureaucracy that doesn't really care. You know, they're there, you know, they've got their tenure or their seniority with the government, and they've been there 20 some years, and, you know, nobody's going to fire me, so I really don't care. And, you know, and consequently, you've got, you know, guys that make repeated phone calls to try to get some help, and they feel like they're beating their head against a wall, and, you know, and sadly, they decide to stop the frustration. And
I've read accounts of people that had called the suicide hotline and were put on hold, or no one answered, and they took their own life. And, you know, I think that goes more, you know, the expression of going postal could very easily be going VA. But it's the frustration of the system. I mean, I've been denied disability for a condition that the VA diagnosed. And, you know, the frustration and the time delays is terrible. So from OPSEC's point of view, you know, we're trying to hit on some of the key cabinet positions that affect soldiers, and the VA is extremely important to us. And although it doesn't have direct impact on national security per se, that is certainly going to be on OPSEC's watch list.
Now, let me ask you a question about the appointment to my old agency of Congressman Pompeo.
Ah, well, yep, another one. I'm a fan of Mike Pompeo. He's a no-nonsense guy. He's a West Point graduate. Not sure how long he had in the Army. But I watched him, you know, if you're a news geek and you watch C-SPAN like me, you know, I've watched him at the different congressional hearings, you know, not just Benghazi, but he has keen insight. He's a no-nonsense guy. And I think he's a good man for the job.
I certainly hope so, because some of you know, some of the things that I hear, you know, the agency wasting their time on, same thing with the Department of Defense, you know, the concern at the agency seems to be over transgender bathrooms. You know, the same with the what's being wasted, the time being wasted, you know, in the Department of Defense now over the same issue, when you might have three, you know, that fit that category. It's just, you know, those are it's maddening, you know, to professionals of the military and the intelligence community. You want to pull your hair out when our efforts are being diverted from you know, areas that that they need to be focused on, because we're trying to be politically correct. And you know, hopefully he will rectify those situations as well.
Well, and I think this is what we're starting to see is redefining of the culture, which has to be drastically redefined after 8 years of political correctness and nonsense, in my view.
Social engineering.
Social engineering. And the military, their sole job is to protect this country and our national interests with the least expenditure of American treasure life as possible. And the military is no place for a social experiment. Has nothing to do with being anti-gay or anti-woman or anti-whatever. It's just a matter of what works. And the military is so different from anything, really. I mean, it is a microcosm of society at large, and we draw from all walks. I think we've had gays in the military since there were gays and there was a military, and they continued to serve. I don't think that any of this legislation was necessary. The don't ask, don't tell thing, that was the de facto policy that had always been there before they articulated it as policy. But this social engineering, my God.
It was working fine. You know, the reason that it was changed was because you had people from that community who literally just wanted to force acceptance of a lifestyle, and one of the ways of doing that was to force, you know, the military to accept that lifestyle. And, you know, and as you said, there have been people, you know, homosexuals serving in the military forever, and I'm sure, you know, many or most have probably served honorably, and I don't have a problem with that. You know, one of the arguments I got into with someone who I threw out the argument that, you know, the military job is to protect America and kill our enemies, and, you know, and it's not a place where, you know, that needs to be social experimentation that needs to be going on. And they brought up the fact, well, look at desegregation of the military, you know, and blacks were integrated into the military under Truman, I believe it was. And my response to them was, you know, race is a whole lot different than a person's sexuality. A person's sexuality is much more intimate and much more personal than, you know, having objections over race or whatever. And so I don't buy the argument that it's the same thing, because it's not. You know, again, a sexuality is much more of a personal, private issue among people than you know, someone's race is.
And that goes to just the sexuality. I mean, involving what they call gender, or, you know, just with women. You know, it's, you know, yeah, women have equal rights, but are women truly equal? Well, not in all things. there's certain things that women physically cannot do that most men can do. And sure, there's some men that can't do them, but, you know, we're talking about law of averages. But then there's the dynamics of sexuality and relationships. It's hard enough in an office environment, but to have this forced into the military. Now, I've been a proponent of women in SOF, in special operations. There's a precedent for that. There's always been women in special operations since we had it, and as well as intelligence. Let's face it, women are going to have access places that men will never have. And, you know, as far as women in a SEAL platoon or on an A detachment, absolutely not. But I think, you know, and guys, you know, this whole separate but equal kind of thing, there is a place for women. But when it's forced, I mean, rapidly forced on some social agenda, it's never going to work out.
And you don't upset the entire military to accommodate a minuscule number of people. You know, say you've got two women out of 1,000 soldiers who want to command a platoon in combat. So you're going to upset the other 998 military soldiers in that, the standards, the training, everything, to accommodate two people. You don't do that. I mean, I'm sorry. You know, it's a shame. Yeah, I'm sorry that you two women can't command a platoon in combat. You know, sucks to be you. You know, the bottom line is the military's job isn't to accommodate you. The military's job is to kill our enemies and defend this country. And they do that by utilizing the best people and doing it the best way possible. And if that means excluding you from certain jobs because of your gender, then so be it. That's the job of the military, to kill our enemies and to do it the best way, the most efficient way possible.
I thought that the Department of Defense had done a commendable job of integrating women just in my 30-year career. I've seen a tremendous evolution. And this had nothing to do with legislation or a presidential agenda or directives. This was done on its own. There were combat arms positions that were opened up, combat aviation. And yeah, women can fly helicopters and fighter jets as capably as any man can, but they can't carry. I was 160 pounds at the time, and I carried a rucksack that was at least 110 pounds. And there's not a whole lot of women out there that can do that. There's not a whole lot of men out there that can do that and go through the same gates. But and then another thing was the war on religion. There would be civil outcry had it been done in our communities, but the Obama administration wanted to mess with the military chaplains. And, you know, this whole thing about taking God out of the military, soldiers need spiritual guidance because sometimes that's all they have left when things get really, really bad.
I've got a family member who's in the military, and they've always been very active in their religion, their church, but they've certainly seen some restrictions, under this administration placed on their religious practices.
Well, I think the social experiment for the military is going to become a thing of the past. There's some things that probably can't be undone, but I think the whole politicization of intelligence has done us a great disservice. Intelligence is what it is or what it is not. It's either fact or premise, but it shouldn't be driven by a political agenda. You do a disservice to the president you're advising, even if that's what he wants to hear, and you're doing a disservice to national security and the American people.
No, I agree, and it's not, it's not something that should be used as a tool to, as you just said, to promote a certain political agenda or whatever. I mean, the, you know as well as I do, having also, you know, you've been in the intelligence business as well. And I mean, it's not an exact science by any means. And, you know, certainly some things can be determined as fact based on intelligence operations or activities or whatever, but a lot of it is you know, analytical at best, and you know, you offer a supposition as to, you know, what the data implies, but certainly, you know, you can't, you know, hang your hat on all of it. And when you've got an outside force that's influencing that, it is not serving this country well. You know, it might serve that president well because it matches his political agenda and what he's trying to promote, but it doesn't serve the country well. And the intelligence community is not there just to serve the president and his administration. It's there to serve this country.
Well, I think the other thing that doesn't impact directly, and you touched on it earlier, was, you know, for generations, for 30 years or more, is the subtle indoctrination of America's youth. And I hope that Ms. DeVos, Betsy DeVos, I guess she was for Common Core, but now she's against it. When Jeb Bush thought that Betsy DeVos was a good choice, that made me a little bit nervous. We get Stacey Shore on here to talk about this, but the Common Core has been disastrous for this country, and it has dumbed down. I was lucky to have a good education, and part of that maybe was Jesuits, a little bit of corporal punishment as well. But, you know, the kids today, I mean, you know, even at Ivy League schools, I'm thinking, my God, these people are going to be our future leaders. And just not understanding.
Oh, it's scary.
The facts are being propagandized. And it's not history, it's propaganda.
Oh, it's indoctrination. You've got leftist college professors who have never lived in the real world. Their entire life has been within the confines of the academic community. They went to grade school, they went to high school, they went to college, and once they graduated from college, they got their BA, then they went on to get their master's and their doctorate, and the whole time they stayed in the academic community, they worked in the academic community. Now they've been professors for, you know, decades, and they've never, ever held a real job. They've never served in the military. They've never done anything other than sit around. And I like to use the example. You remember the movie Blazing Saddles?
Of course.
One of the funniest scenes was Mel Brooks was the governor, and he was standing around in his office, and there were several other gentlemen standing around, all dressed in suits and that. And his response to a comment or whatever was, "Harumph." And then he had to point at all the other ones and say, "I didn't get a harumph from you." Well, that's what these I use that example. That's what these college professors do, is they stand around and go harumph all day to each other, you know, thinking lofty, great thoughts and that, and have absolutely no understanding of life in the real world, of the challenges that these young people are going to face when they get out in the real world with their flashy new college degree that qualifies them to do nothing but maybe operate the French fry machine at a McDonald's.
It's good to be the king.
That is the reality in colleges and universities nowadays, is a ideological agenda that's being force-fed to young, impressionable minds who many of those have not been given the right upbringing by their own parents. So, and so they're susceptible to it. And it's a scary future that we face when we've got people like this who need a safe space because somebody said a hurtful thing.
And Del, I thank you again for joining us today, and I thank the listeners, and we'll catch you next week.